From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of South Africa's most popular actors, John Kane. Kane is black. During the apartheid era, he broke the law by performing in a company with white playwright Ethel Fugard. Their company was famous for its anti-apartheid plays, including Sizwe Banzwe is Dead and The Island. Kane directs the Market Theater in South Africa. He's now performing at Lincoln Center in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth. It's about post-apartheid South Africa, and it's inspired in part by his brother, a poet and activist, who was killed by South African police in 1985. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new 6-DVD set, The Stephen Sondheim Collection. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court has refused to hear an appeal requesting information about foreign nationals who were arrested after the September 11th attacks. About 700 people, mostly Arabs or Muslims, were jailed after the attacks, and many were subsequently deported. None was charged in connection with the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. A federal appeals panel ruled that the government had the authority to keep information about the detainees secret without having to provide individual reasons for each arrest. The Justice Department's Inspector General found last year that there were significant problems with the detentions, including allegations that the prisoners were abused while they were in custody. U.S. troops killed 7 men in Iraq today, part of a larger group allegedly trying to steal oil from a pipeline. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
The 7 were among about 40 men trying to siphon fuel from a pipeline near Samarra, north of Baghdad. A U.S. military spokesperson said the thieves had a dozen or so trucks and were armed with AK-47 rifles. They shot as U.S. troops approached, according to the military. The Americans used rifles and 125-millimeter cannon, destroying 4 trucks and killing 7 men. Iraq has the world's second-largest reserves of oil, but the country is plagued by fuel shortages. A lack of gasoline has led to long lines at filling stations. That and a shortage of heating fuel is contributing to Iraqi anger. Officials say widespread smuggling contributes significantly to the problem, along with corruption and attacks on pipelines. Congress recently approved $2 billion to repair Iraq's oil infrastructure. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
Democratic presidential contender and Massachusetts Senator John Kerry picked up a key endorsement today in Iowa from the wife of that state's governor. NPR's David Wellner reports from Des Moines.
Kristi Vilsack, the wife of Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, announced she supports Kerry's bid for the Democratic presidential nomination with just a week to go before Iowa's caucuses formally inaugurate this year's presidential race. The governor himself has abstained from endorsing any of the Democrats competing in these key caucuses. But Kerry's campaign considers the nod from Kristi Vilsack the next best thing to a gubernatorial endorsement. Polls published over the weekend show Kerry battling for a third-place finish in Iowa, with North Carolina Senator John Edwards, who picked up a key endorsement Sunday from Iowa's biggest newspaper, the Des Moines Register. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean and Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt are the top contenders here for first and second place finishes. They're now running neck and neck. David Walnut, NPR News, Des Moines.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26 points to close at 10,485 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 24 points, or nearly 1.2%. It closed at 2111. This is NPR News. Jury selection in the trial of former Roman Catholic Bishop Thomas O'Brien got underway in Phoenix today. O'Brien resigned last summer after being involved in a fatal hit-and-run accident. Mark Moran reports from member station KJZZ.
2 weeks before the accident that left a man dead, O'Brien had made a deal with the county attorney here that allowed him to sidestep prosecution for allegedly covering up allegations of sexual abuse. People who say that priests in the Phoenix diocese sexually molested them as youngsters claim that O'Brien was told about the allegations but covered them up and sent the accused priests to other congregations in Arizona. O'Brien is on trial for leaving the scene of the fatal hit-and-run accident in Phoenix in June. Police traced the license plate number of the car to O'Brien's house, where they found the windshield of his vehicle caved in. If he's convicted, the 68-year-old O'Brien could face up to 4 years in prison or be sentenced to probation. Testimony in the trial is scheduled to begin next week. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Authorities in St. Louis say 26 elementary school children and the driver of their school bus were hurt today when the bus flipped over. John Parrish of the Missouri State Highway Patrol says the driver was forced to stop quickly because of traffic congestion.
The school bus driver basically did not realize traffic was stopping in time, swerved to the left to avoid rear-ending another vehicle, and then overcorrected when she steered back to the right, and the bus overturned, turned on its left side, and then slid about 100 feet before it came to rest.
Emergency medical officials say the driver and one of the children were seriously hurt. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 5 points to close at 1127. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Kane, is one of South Africa's leading actors. During the apartheid era, he was a member of the Serpent Players, which included the white playwright Ethel Fugard. This group violated the law simply by being integrated. The group is most famous for its productions of two Fugard plays, Sizwe Bonzwe is Dead and The Island, about the prison Robben Island. Kane won a 1975 Tony Award for his performance on Broadway in Sizwe Bonzwe is Dead. Today he directs the Market Theater in Johannesburg. Now he's starring in a production of a play he wrote about post-apartheid South Africa called Nothing But the Truth. It's being performed at Lincoln Center until January 18th. The play looks at truth, lies, and reconciliation by focusing on two brothers. Kane plays Sipo, a librarian nearing retirement who was overshadowed by his younger brother Temba, a famous anti-apartheid activist who had lived in exile in London. As the play opens, Sipo is at the funeral of his younger brother, whose ashes have been returned for burial in South Africa. Here's Connie performing an excerpt of the play. Sipo, his character, is the assistant chief librarian who had always wanted to be promoted to chief.
So, you win again, Temba. I'm still dull. Nothing good is for me. I'm still at the library, and I'm not even the chief librarian and will never be. If this country was free, I used to say to myself, if we had a black government, I would be the chief librarian. I watched the release of Nelson Mandela on television, and I said to myself, my time has come. I was 57 years old when I voted for the first time in my life in 1994. I made Nelson Mandela the first democratically elected president of this country. I was 62 years old when I voted again in 1999. No one said to me I was too old. How come I'm not too old to put them in power and suddenly I'm too old to be empowered?
John Kane told me he created this character to celebrate the unknown citizens who served in South Africa without reward.
Those who were in the marches, but we're not in the front row, so you never see their picture. Those who were part of the protest, but they were just one of the thousands. Those who stood 5 hours on the queue in 1994 on the 27th of April, waiting to vote to give birth to South Africa's new democracy, but you never hear about their names. You didn't see them in the media. CNN and television didn't have their faces. So Sipho, the character who stays, is an ordinary South African. Unfortunately, things don't turn out his way, because at the time that he's due for promotion, he's already 63 years old. The brother who left is Temba. He was a member of the movement within South Africa, a political activist, a firebrand, an orator, loved by everybody, and of course, as all human beings who are in leadership, has a little flaws like everybody else. He's human. He did like the ladies a little, and that didn't make him very popular in certain areas. And as the story unfolds, you will then realize that even his own brother was not spared as a victim in his younger brother's philanderings.
Which brother do you play?
I play the older brother.
Why did you choose that brother for yourself?
I wrote the play from a point of the older brother, because when I started writing, I wanted to pay tribute to my brother, Olile, who was a poet. He was shot in 1985 at a funeral of a 9-year-old girl who was hit by a tear gas canister. At that funeral during the 80s, we used to use the funerals as political rallies to mobilize the people to rise against apartheid, to get the people not to give up hope, to continue the fight for the liberation of South Africa. So funerals were quite important platforms to be used by political activists. So the police came, 10,000 people attended this funeral. Within 2 minutes, hell broke loose. There was pandemonium, shots were ringing, tear gas all over the place. In fact, at that funeral, something for the first time happened. Shots rang also from the crowd, because ordinarily the police or the soldiers will shoot and people will run away. This time fire was returned, which marked the presence of the insurgents or liberation forces within South Africa. So at the end of that, 4 bodies lay on the ground, and only one of them had a name, Xolile, John Kani's brother. The others were just unknown 3 black youths. So in 1996, when the Truth and Reconciliation hearings came to my town, everybody wanted to know if we were going to go to these hearings to find out who killed my brother and why. My mother said no.
Why?
She said, no, I have been watching the television and listening to the radio. So many elderly people like me have been telling their story. I feel my story has been told. I don't think it's necessary for us to go there, and it's not going to bring my son back. My mother was a matriarch and a very powerful woman, so there's nothing we could do. We all agreed, Mom's right. But in me, there was no closure. In me, there was still bitterness and anger. In me, there was still that wanting some kind of revenge. I just didn't know what kind of revenge, but I did want something. And writing the play was, for me, trying to deal with that, to bring closure. Because every time I tried to think about my brother, I always thought, oh, he would have published a lot of poems now, or he should be doing this now, or he could be married with 4 children and successful, or, oh, he could be overseas now. These are the things he should be doing. I could never see him in my mind resting. So after writing the play in the year 2001, completed it early 2002, that first performance was cathartic. That first performance was therapy. I mean, every ounce of my body heaved and gave in. At the end of it, with the audiences, with the thunderous applause, I mean, there were tears in my eyes. And I felt so good, so relieved, so the weight taken off my shoulders. I went home, visited his grave, and I stood there and just thanked him. And as from that day, I now remember my brother with fondness, with great pride of the price he paid so that I could be not only a free citizen of South Africa, but a free citizen of the world.
Were you at the funeral that he was shot at?
No, I wasn't, because I had just come back from England, and I called him that I wanted to talk to him.
From living there, or just from touring there?
From touring and performing.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been at the funeral if I had been at home quite longer. So I just arrived. So he just told me that he won't be long. They're just going to do a couple of his poems. And there were a group, you know, of young poets. Go to the funeral and then we'll talk later.
And how did you find out the news?
2 young boys, aged 8 and 11, walked in and said, "Excuse me, are you Uncle John Kani?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you know Xolile Kani?" I said, "Yes." He says, "He's been shot at the funeral in Mqandi Street." So I just got in the car, drove like a madman, got there. There were just a few people wandering, and there was nothing. But you could see the chaos around and still smell the tear gas. And I asked, and people said the police took all the bodies and drove away with them in an ambulance. So I started the search for my brother because I still had the hope perhaps he was still alive. I went to the local hospitals, clinics, police station, and after 7 hours, I finally got a tip from a young man. So I finally went to the police mortuary and I saw his body. He was shot 3 times in his stomach with a shotgun. The district surgeon said that he was shot at a close range of less than 2 or 3 meters. That's about 6 or 9 feet away from him.
Did the police deny that they shot him?
The police said there were a lot of young people attacking them with stones, with bullets, with everything, and they opened fire to defend their lives. So they would not know whether he in particular was one of those people they shot. Even the magistrate or the judge said the police acted under extreme provocation and none of them could be individually or even collectively held responsible for the death of my brother. So it's almost appeared that no one shot him, but he's dead.
Did you and your brother have strong disagreements about what type of activism was the most potent anti-apartheid activism?
Like me and my eldest brother, who spent 5 years on Robben Island, I saw him as a radical. He was more concerned and worried about me. He felt that perhaps I wasn't as strong as he was. He also felt that I was a little reckless because I would often shoot my mouth. And my association, of course, with people like Athol Fugard and the media and going abroad, he said, you've got to be more careful. You've got to be more careful. You know, the white people would be protected, but you are unprotected. So my brother was more pan-Africanist. He was a member of the African Writers Association, which was an organization which wasn't allowing white writers to be members. So it was almost like for Africans only. He always queried relationship with white people, saying that it was diluting the strength of the struggle. It's creating an impression that there are a lot of white people who are part of the struggle for the liberation of South Africa, which was true. But this was a tease between me and him when we would sit down and discuss what I would really want to do with him, politics. But it was a mild joke between the two of us. Come on, you got to come in the strength of the struggle. You can't carry these whites with you.
Well, the fact that you worked with white and black actors and playwrights is exactly what made that troupe like so unique. You know, the most notable of the white people in the troupe was Athol Fugard, the now
yes.
famous playwright. So this was a very unique company in South Africa, a very important one. So I imagine you felt very strongly about the importance of having this group that was comprised of black and white people.
No, actually, there was one member who was white.
Oh, it was just Athol Fugard. Oh.
Yes, the rest of the group was black.
Oh.
Or from New Brighton, my township. Only Athol was the member. In fact, we went to Athol in 1961 to ask him to join the group because we had heard about his work. We had heard about his involvement with black theater makers in Johannesburg. Then he moved back to settle in his home, which is in Port Elizabeth. Then we went to speak to him, and he agreed to join the group. It was called the Serpent Players. Ask me now why we were serpents. I still don't know where we got the name, why we couldn't have had an African name. But I joined the group later, and Athol was already a member. Athol was directing most of the works we were doing and also very integral and crucial to the process of improvisation and workshopping, which we called experiment in playmaking. We knew we had something to say. If we said it our way, it would have been a political statement. He had the ability to clothe this truth we wanted to say in a dramatic form, which was part of entertainment and informing and educating our audience that evening.
Did he, in a way, offer protection for the members of the group, too, since it might have been more difficult to attack the group with a white member in it than if the group was only comprised of of black performers and writers, that the authorities would have been able to probably get away with it easier.
Oh, no. Oh, no. He was in a more precarious position because he was white.
He was in a more precarious position?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, because he was seen as his government as a traitor,
oh.
a sellout to his own nation. He was seen as a communist. And what he was doing, working with us, with such a political and a militant group of blacks, was treason on his side. But he was more ostracized by the white media, by the white community, and by the white police force, which was making sure that any element of resistance was eliminated and obliterated. So I used to say to him, at least I could go back to my community that is proud of what I'm doing. You go back to your community that is looking at you as a sellout.
My guest is South African playwright and actor John Kane. He's currently performing at Lincoln Center in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Kane. He's one of South Africa's leading actors and playwrights. His play, Nothing But the Truth, is now being performed at Lincoln Center. He wrote it and he's starring in it. What's the worst thing that happened to you that, you know, that the government did to you as a result of your theatrical work?
Well, in 1975, we won the Tony Awards for Best Actor, me and Winston Jonna. We went back to South Africa.
This was for Sizwe Banzwe Is Dead?
For Sizwe Banzwe Is Dead and the Island. We went back to South Africa. Nobody even knew we'd won that because there was nothing in the media except perhaps for one local newspaper that ran one paragraph saying two black actors win prestigious award in America. End of it. So we started again the tour of South Africa to play in the rural communities, which we felt that they had not had the opportunity to see these plays, both the Island and Sizwe Banzwe Is Dead. We went to this small town in Butterworth and we performed at the town hall. And the audience was mixed. I mean, we were breaking the law left, right, and center. And during the performance, we noticed that some strange-looking men were blocking the exits and they were standing. And at the end of the play, both Winston and I, as we were bowing for the curtain call, were arrested and taken off the stage, went into another car, driven another 150 miles east. I was into another car, driving another 200 miles north. We met each other 23 days later. We were both detained in solitary confinement. And we met again on the 15th day, where he was leaving the interrogation where they brought in him to interrogate him. And I walked in and I was also constantly being interrogated. I mean, the charges were furthering the aims of communism. Charges were inciting people to public violence. Charges were furthering the aims of the African National Congress, a banned organization, and promoting hatred among races. And you just, they went on and on and on. And none of them simply said for doing a play. And then at the...
Because the real crimes here for the South African government was that you were doing a play that criticized the government, and you also had a mixed audience, and that was illegal too, right? Yeah,
that was illegal, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, after 23, I think it was about on the 18th day, I got a piece of paper under the door of my cell, and it was so rolled, so tiny, that it took me about 5 to 10 minutes gently to open it without tearing it up. And then I saw it was the a local newspaper saying, Kane and John are still in detention. Massive demonstrations in New York, London, Paris, Australia, Sydney. Oh, my. I celebrated that evening. I felt so good because I knew now nothing can happen to me. The world knows I'm here, so they can't kill me now. So at least I could sleep.
Do you think that they might have killed you had there not been demonstrations?
Many people disappeared. Many people disappeared. You picked up and get detained, and when people inquire, the police would tell them, no, this person was released 4 days ago. We don't know where this person is. And that's part of the pain of the truth and reconciliation, because it was those people who were claimed to have been released that the security police were confessing of having killed them, actually, and buried them or burned their bodies. We had known a very good friend of mine, Mobs Grichan, went to town just to go and buy a few things, and I never saw him again. And I've never heard of him since, even now. The Pepco Tree, which is three wonderful activists in my own town, were told to go and meet a friend of theirs at the airport, Sipo Hashe and Godolozi and the others, and Galela. And they disappeared. And during the Truth and Reconciliation, the police confessed having intercepted the car on the way to the airport, took them to an old farm, interrogated them, beat them to death, and burnt their bodies. So it was a common fear that if you are detained, you could disappear.
From what you're saying about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I would gather that you think their efforts were good efforts, and that it was important to have such a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Absolutely, absolutely. I am 110% mm-hmm. in support of the Truth and Reconciliation and amnesty.
Even though it gives amnesty to the people who confess?
Even if it gives the amnesty to the people who confess, even if to those who did not confess, mm-hmm. we had to move forward. Mm-hmm. The biggest prize that we got out of this struggle was the freedom of our people, the democracy, and the land that South Africa belongs to all of us. That, for me, is the biggest and noblest prize. But in the play, I examine that reconciliation in the family context, where because South Africa was not only between black and white, it was also between white and white, it was also between black and black. Mm-hmm. So I felt that we also needed reconciliation within family, between black and black. And that's why Nothing But the Truth deals between two brothers, you know, who are part of the struggle, but played different roles.
John Kane is starring in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth. Its run at Lincoln Center continues through Sunday. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The 37th Hour, a novel of suspense by Jodi Compton that follows a missing persons cop searching for her missing lover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the role of theater now in post-apartheid South Africa. We continue our conversation with actor and playwright John Kane. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the DVD box set, The Stephen Sondheim Collection. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Kane, a South African actor and playwright. He became well known during the apartheid era as a member of the Serpent Players, which violated the law by being integrated. It was comprised of black actors and the white playwright, Athol Fugard. Now Kane directs the Market Theater in Johannesburg. He's currently in New York, starring in a production of his play about post-apartheid South Africa, Nothing But the Truth. Its run at Lincoln Center continues through Sunday. How did you start acting? I imagine as a black South African, and you weren't exposed to a lot of theater when you were growing up.
Oh, no. There has been a lot of township theater from the 1834s. Stories about our lives, great kings, township life. There's been a lot of it, but not in the kind of theater houses that were only in the white suburbs or white towns of South Africa.
Right.
And there was also the movie industry, which we call the cinema and the bioscope, where we saw all the great movies of the Indians being chased by John Wayne, Roy Rogers. We went to the movies and walked out very angry that the Indians lost all the time, irrespective of how many they were. We saw the war movies and then saw the karate, the kung fu movies and all those things. But at school, there was a wonderful teacher, English teacher, who was an aspiring dramatist who used us to dramatize our novels, short stories, poetry, and we did a lot of Shakespeare because it was prescribed work for us to do at school. And it was during those days that the interest in theater grew stronger and stronger and stronger. And then when I left school trying to find a career, I went to work at Ford Motor Company, which was an American company at the assembly plant, assembling engines, and that's where the experience is in Sizwe Banzi Is Dead, of the visit of Mr. Henry Ford in 1965 to South Africa, who never saw us at all, and though we were told that he was a very important person, but he never saw us at all. And all those things, so when I heard about this group called the Serpent Players, I went to check them out, and they were doing a play called Antigone by Sophocles. And I walked in and I saw this white person. I thought, whoops, this is dangerous. We're going to be in trouble here. I didn't know the group had a white member. And I was very nervous about any time the police would come in, we'd be in trouble here. But what Arthur was saying about this play, Antigone, was Antigone right to break the law? Was Antigone right to defy the state? Was Antigone right to do what is right in her heart and in the eyes of God, irrespective of the fact that the state had banned the burial of her own brother? That, for me, proved that the marriage between art and politics in the South African context would last for a very long time.
Now that apartheid is over, are you ever in the position of seeing people in the theater or on the street or at dinners and receptions who you know had worked against you during the apartheid years, either worked against you in the theater or worked as police or in any other, you know, capacity where you knew that you had been one of their targets?
Yes, of course. There was a particular person in my town in Port Elizabeth, New Brighton, who made me and Winston Jonner his personal responsibility. He was a lieutenant warrant officer of the special branch. Every time Winston and I returned from a trip abroad, he would come and visit and annoy us with asking all these 900 silly questions. Who did you meet? Who did you do this? Always kept saying, South Africa will never, never change. This is a God-created situation. They were the chosen people, not the Jews, and that South Africa was their country. And we didn't have the brains to become a free people or even to think we could govern. And all those things, you know, the terrible things he used to say. And I used to think that one day, if this country is free, I'll find him and I will make sure he also spends a day or two in detention, then just to make him feel, you know, how he treated us. In 1994, when we voted and we won, and Mandela was inaugurated as the first president, democratically elected. It was so strange. I really just wanted to see him, to see this man and say, hello, how are you? By the way, we were right, you were wrong. That's all I wanted to say.
Did you ever get to do that?
No, he died because he was quite elderly. And I have no feeling, really, I mean, towards him. I'm just laughing because he was stupid. You can't turn the tide of freedom. You can't. The people who fight for freedom will be free. They've got God on their side. They've got time on their side. They've got the truth on their side. It doesn't matter how strong the enemy is. It's only delaying the inevitable.
Sometimes authoritarian governments, repressive governments, give this kind of extra special power and mystique to the arts, to literature, to theater, to music, by suppressing it. And, you know, many writers and other artists have noted that sometimes their art has a lot more power when they're working under the repressive government. And then when the repression ends, sometimes people don't care that much about the art and that power that the underground novel had or that the band play had, you know, is kind of dissipated. I'm wondering if you found something similar, that the power of theater wasn't quite as powerful once there was freedom.
Yes, of course. We, as I always say, 1994 and democracy crash landed on us. We were very famous because we were in the era of protest theater, mm-hmm. and protest art. Writers, sculptors, poets, you know, musicians, artists, all of us, you know, we spoke about the suffering of the human being, the inhumanity of men to men. And in 1994, South Africa became a democracy. We used to write plays demanding the release of Nelson Mandela. He was president. We used to write plays attacking the state. Now it was our state. We used to write plays attacking the vicious laws of a government. Now it was our government. Our society was changing right around us, and we were in the midst of that change. From 1994, 95, 96, there was this silence, this confusion, this state of transition, where we did not know what to write about, what to say. The stories we wanted to tell were still straddling the past and were part of the pain of the past. But we needed to understand that past in order to deal with the present and may even venture to look at what the future holds for us. Even our audiences who used to support that kind of work, especially in the theater that I run, the Market Theater in Johannesburg, our audiences dropped to almost 10%. And every play we were putting on was not drawing an audience. And we had to hold conferences and symposiums and discuss where the new South African work must come from, where these voices are. People just began, those that had resources and money, mostly white producers, brought in new plays from abroad, new acts and musicians from Michael Jackson to Janet Jackson to Tom Jones to Whitney Houston to Pavarotti to the Lord of the Dance, to everything they can bring in that sort of filled in the gap of uncertainty. But by 1997, a new sort of voice began to emerge. We began to find our feet. We began to identify what the stories we now telling are about. And Nothing But the Truth is one of those major breakthroughs into what South African theater voice is now.
My guest is South African playwright and actor John Kane. He directs the Market Theater in Johannesburg. He's now starring in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth, at Lincoln Center. It's about post-apartheid South Africa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is South African playwright and actor John Kane. He's starring in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth, at Lincoln Center. It's about post-apartheid South Africa. I'm wondering what your older brother, your brother who was a member of the ANC and who spent 5 years in Robben Island prison, what is he doing now?
Oh, he's at home. He's retired. He was a counselor in Port Elizabeth, and now he's doing a small business for himself, and he is happy. But in the strangest thing, we discuss a lot of things, but never those 5 years. I don't know why. Every time I try to make him talk about what happened, he says, it was tough, but we made it. He never gets into detail in telling me what happened. So we have a fantastic relationship. He's happy and he's doing very well.
It sounds like a lot of people who return from war and don't want to talk about what happened there.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you want to know, like, on a day-to-day, I want the 5 years times 365.
I want to know. You want it all.
He never allows us to talk about it. He always changes the subject, and I leave him alone. Now I've known that. I've heard stories and pieces there and there, and we put them together in my mind. I know it was tough for him. It was tough for Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, and all the great brothers and sisters, of course, were kept in other prisons in South Africa. But it's not a secret they're keeping, but they just feel that to know that they suffered for what we are enjoying and we all went through the struggle is good enough to give us the hope for tomorrow.
Do you feel like you'll ever be at the point where you want to, you know, do like a musical comedy?
I wanted to do No, No, Nanette all my life. I don't know what it is about.
Why No, No, Nanette?
I don't know. I've always used that line, No, No, Nanette. I'd love to be in a farce, a comedy, where I rush on stage and the blood boils and the audience is standing and I'm tapping and I'm running out backstage and saying, I don't know what it is about, but I'm having a good time. I have chosen, as a storyteller, this kind of story, which is part of my existence. I did do a movie 4 years ago called Soweto Green, which was a comedy. A great, great fuss of a South African who lived in L.A., studied botany and zoology, comes back just after 1994, people welcoming that the politician is back, and yet he's just a botanist. He wants to plant trees in Soweto to fight pollution, the air pollution. People are crazy. They say, no, we want you to lead us to the freedom to be part of the parliament. He says, no, I studied in L.A. I want to be a botanist, a zoologist. I want to fight the ozone layer. So it was such a farce. And it was an incredible performance. It was a hit in South Africa. It ran for a long time.
I thought it's this way Bansway is dead as being comedic. Because it was about, in part, the absurdity of apartheid.
Exactly. I mean, the most important ingredient in our work during the days of apartheid was humor. We knew that without humor, we called our people to a political meeting. With humor, we're calling them to witness and be part of an event, a journey, and we're going to have a good time tonight, but we're going to learn and hear about things that are important. Humor is that, it's therapy. I come from a long line of storytellers. My grandfather had 3 wives and could not spell polygamy. And I used to go to each grandmother, and the stories would make us laugh. But at the end of the stories, we learned a very good lesson about life.
You had been, and I'm not sure if you still are, the curator or chair of the Apartheid Museum?
Yes, I am the chair of the Apartheid Museum and part of the founder of the group of people who came together with the concept of creating a monument, some memory where the younger generation may forget. It's now the second most important place to visit in South Africa after Robben Island is the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg, which is an experiential journey which begins in 1948 with the rise of white nationalism and ends at the inauguration of Thabo Mbeki and still has little indications of where the country is going today.
Is there any part of you that would like to do a Hollywood movie or two?
Yes, I do when I get the opportunity. I do. I've About 2 or 3 years ago, I did The Ghost and the Darkness with Michael Douglas and Val Kilmer. And I did another one called The Final Solution, which is a South African movie. And there are movies in the pipeline that I'm thinking about and talking, people are talking about. But I'd love to, my agent being the William Morris Agency, very good friend of mine, Samuel Leaf, always says, do you think I should get you a Hollywood big movie? I said, yes, so that I could make the money and then be able to have time to write the plays.
Now that apartheid has been over for about a decade, and you can theoretically live any place you want to in South Africa, what kind of neighborhood are you living in?
The economics are still prohibitive. You have about nearly 38 to 40 million black people who lived in sub-conditions, sub-economic conditions. Not all of them are now able, within 10 years, to make enough money to move uptown or move to the east side or move to the suburbs where houses are still in prices themselves are beyond their ability and capability. Well, we who at least can afford, I live in an ordinary suburb, which is in town, closer to my work and closer to the schools where the kids are. These are the kinds of excuses of moving up we give ourselves because we now have money to buy a house in the so-called former white areas. We say, it's closer to the school. It's closer to my work. It's got closer to wonderful facilities around it. Shut up and say, I have money to buy a better house. And that's it.
You almost feel like you have to apologize for it.
You do, because you leave your own community and you know that the living conditions where you are going are much, much, much better than where you were. And you don't want to lose contact with where you came from, nor from your people. But you have to accept the upward mobility. It's part of the economy, the economics of the country and the way we live. But you always feel like you need to explain yourself.
Do you have any children?
Yes, I have 8 children.
Are any of them under 10, or have any of them grown up only in the post-apartheid era?
The last two, Anati was born in 1991, Akum was born in 1994.
Is that amazing to you that they will have never known that system?
I can tell you now, the others that were born in the 80s were now at universities and are questioning why we allowed it to happen for so long. They're almost like saying, come on, Dad, you mean you couldn't do that? Why? Why didn't you just tell them to get off? You're going to do it. They don't understand.
Yeah.
And the younger ones who had been with me with their mother just now, they don't know anything about it. And they're just looking at you as if it's once upon a time. When I'm trying to tell them, they say, here we go again. He's going to tell us that they were never used to eat here. They never used to do that. They never used to go there. They never used to be allowed there. Please, Daddy, can we get on with it? We're here now. So you think places like the Apartheid Museum and, of course, the tradition of storytelling, which is so African, still continues, though it's not as strong as it was, where parents hand over the history orally to the younger ones. We still do that. Whether they're listening or not, we tell them what happened.
John Connie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Connie directs the Market Theatre in Johannesburg. He's now starring in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth. Its run at Lincoln Center continues through Sunday. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new DVD box set, The Stephen Sondheim Collection. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Sondheim's latest musical, Bounce, didn't survive its out-of-town tryout period and never made it to Broadway. But we can read about Sondheim in the new book about the creation of his show Follies, and we can watch some choice Sondheim at home on a new 6-DVD set of fully staged and concert performances. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a great fan of Sondheim's and has this review.
In one of the best songs ever written, Rodgers and Hart's I Wish I Were in Love Again, love is defined as the furtive sigh, the blackened eye, the words, I'll love you till the day I die, the self-deception that believes the lie. Probably the truest heir to this honest and unsentimental view of human relationships in popular music is Stephen Sondheim. Often, his characters are too self-absorbed to be aware of what would please their partners. At one extreme, there's Sweeney Todd, the title character of Sondheim's grim, near opera about the demon barber of Fleet Street. He's so bent on revenge that killing becomes more important than the affection of Mrs. Lovett, his partner in crime. She's the one who chops up the bodies of Sweeney's victims and turns them into tasty meat pies. In Sunday in the Park with George, Sondheim's Pulitzer Prize-winning musical about the great French pointillist Georges Seurat. It's an obsession with art that threatens the artist's capacity for human contact. Yet in Passion, an infirm older woman's obsession with a handsome young soldier finally, at the cost of her life, rescues him from his own selfishness. It takes two, the baker and his wife realize in Sondheim's mélange of dark fairy tales into the woods.
You've changed. You're daring. You're different in the woods. More sure, more sharing. You're getting us through the woods. If you could see, you're the man who started and much more open-hearted than I knew you to be.
It takes two.
These shows, along with an all-star concert version of Follies, are part of an exciting set of 6 DVDs devoted to Sondheim. And there's a terrific new book about the complexities of putting on a big Broadway musical, Ted Chapin's Everything Was Possible, which is the story of the creation of Follies, one of the most ambitious musicals ever mounted. Chapin is now the director of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Foundation, but 30 years ago, he was an undergraduate at Connecticut College doing an independent research project on musical production by serving as a gopher for Harold Prince and the Follies Company during its often painful tryout period. Chapin took careful notes, and they make a compelling story. One of his most fascinating revelations is that in the course of getting the show together, its creators, Sondheim, Prince, co-director Michael Bennett, and all the designers, were actually in a process of discovering what their show is about. It started out as a murder mystery that takes place at a reunion of former showgirls. But Follies turned into one of theater's deepest explorations of the way we live in the past, and to my mind, even more important, about the way musical comedy itself is not just an escape, but also a mirror of life, a distillation. Follies ends with the main characters expressing their real-life dilemmas as if they were in a series of lavish production numbers. The song, I've Got the God, Why Don't You Love Me, Oh You Do, I'll See You Later, Blues, could have been the story of my own relationship with the person I took to see Follies in its Boston tryout, a period Chapin writes about with particular eloquence. Here's Mandy Patinkin on the Follies in Concert DVD.
I got those God, why don't you love me, oh you do, I'll see you later, Blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters, feeling.
that if I'm good enough for you, you're not good enough. And thank you for the present, but what's wrong with this stuff? Just don't come any closer, because you know how much I love you. Feelings! Those tell me that you love me or you did. I gotta run now. Blues.
The six DVDs are all good, the best of them being Passion, with a magnificent performance by Donna Murphy. Into the Woods, with Bernadette Peters and the rest of the original Broadway cast, and Follies in Concert, which is worth the price of the whole set just for Barbara Cook's heartbreaking rendition of Sondheim's greatest torch song, Losing My Mind.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know, it's like I'm losing my mind. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights.
The paradox of Sondheim is that he's most original, most himself, and most true to life when he's using and transforming familiar musical styles. Some people regard his view of life and love as cynical. Some people call him a disillusioned romantic. For me, especially when his songs are in quotation marks, he's musical theater's greatest, and perhaps at the moment, its only realist.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor at the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Connie Lockwood. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm just a Broadway baby. Walking off my tired feet. Pounding 42nd Street. To be in a show. Oh, Broadway, baby. Making rounds all afternoon.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, fighting the insurgency in Iraq, we talk with journalist Peter Moss about counterinsurgency expert Major John Nagle, who is putting his theories to work for the first time in the Sunni Triangle. It's the subject of Moss's New York Times Magazine cover story. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.